Welcome, everybody. This is the House Committee on Rural Communities, Land Use, and Water. And today is Thursday, April the 2nd. And we have a lot of people here on a lot of different topics. So we're going to try and expeditiously move through our work that we absolutely have to get done here, called work sessions, for those of you who are new. And then we'll do our public hearings. So let me open a work session on House Bill 3274. No.
Okay. So, could you start a different work session?
We're doing all the work sessions, okay. But I can do another one.
Yeah.
Let me open a public, or let me close that work session, because who do we need? Wilson?
Yeah, Wilson.
Does he need to speak on it?
No, it's just it either goes to the Joint Ways and Means or he amends it and it doesn't go to Joint Ways and Means. So,
let me open another work session. Let me close that one. Let me open 3169. Nope. Let me open 2830.
2038.
28. We have 2830 and 2038. Let's do 2830 first. We took that off.
Yeah. It's so 2038.
Let me close the public hearing from. No. Let me close the work session on 2830 and open a work session on House Bill 2038. And Representative Huffman's here. All right.
Okay. Chair Clem, I move to adopt the -3 amendments dated 3/26/15.
A Vice Chair Post moves the -3 amendments dated 3/26/15. Let me just tell you what's happened since we last heard this bill. We convened a work group of the pilots and some of the rural airstrip owners and the trial lawyers, and we worked out these -3 amendments that still give some new liability protections for the rural airstrip owners. There's sort of a split mechanism. It's when people land on your property and they did it without even asking you. That's one higher level of liability. And then if they asked you and you said yes, you're still going to get a higher level of liability protection, but not quite as high. I think the term we use is gross negligence. So if you tell them yes, but then you still sick your pit bull on them after you told them yes, for example, you could get sued. And that's basically the -3 amendments. I don't think we can we get a thumbs up from Representative Huffman over there? All right, there we go. Any further discussion? Seeing none, any objection to the -3 amendments? Seeing none, so adopted.
Chair Clem, I move House Bill 2038 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Post moves House Bill 2038 to the as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, with the clerk, please call the roll.
Representative Gilliam.
Aye.
Representative Gomberg.
Aye.
Representative McLean.
Aye.
Representative Witt.
Excuse.
Vice Chair Helm.
Aye.
Vice Chair Post.
Aye.
Chair Clem.
Aye. Motion passes. The bill is moved to the floor. Representative Huffman, would you like to carry it? There's our carrier. Wilson, no. Okay, let's see if we can get through this one. Let me open a public hearing on House Bill 2434. This is already been considered in another committee, but we had a subsequent referral to our committee, so I think we just have Business Oregon, maybe?
Yes.
If them, even.
So Chris from Business Oregon.
Where's Chris? Yep, come on up. Anybody else testify on this? Yeah, Jeremy's here.
Oh. Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record. My name is Ivo Trumma. I'm the Government Affairs Manager for the Oregon Business Development Department, or Business Oregon for short. This is an agency bill. It came out of the statewide tour that the director undertook when he was appointed over the summer or beginning of the summer together with the Oregon Business Council and other partners. This is a companion bill to another bill that this committee has already seen, House Bill 2435, pardon me, that you voted out to Ways and Means that created the Infrastructure Opportunity Fund. This is a companion piece that will look at innovation in the natural resource world. Think advanced wood products, think mining, think precision agriculture or food processing. It's a new program. It's currently funded in the governor's proposed budget with $5 million. So we'll have to go down to Ways and Means, which I think it already has a subsequent referral. In the interest of time, I'll keep my testimony short. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer, and I'll turn it over to Jeremy.
Great. Thank you. Chair Clem, members of the committee, I'll also be brief. I submitted some written testimony. Jeremy Rogers, for the record, with the Oregon Business Council, and I am the manager of the Oregon Business Plan, which is a collaborative effort with other business groups in the state. And we partnered with Business Oregon on this tour, and in every community that we visited this summer, opportunities to grow our natural resource industries were discussed, and particularly around value-added opportunities, and in particular around food products and around advanced wood products. And what was clear coming out of that is that our natural resource industries are really a sunrise, not a sunset industry, but that requires investment and focus. And we're very focused on innovation when it comes to our urban high-tech industries, and that kind of rigorous focus on innovation and new product development and commercialization of new technologies is just as important in our natural resource sector. Provided you some materials there that summarize some of the recommendations that came out of those meetings, and you can see kind of the genesis of this proposal before you. So with that, I'll just leave it there so you can move on, and happy to take any questions. Thank you.
Questions for these two? It's basically setting up a grant fund. We currently don't have, we just have a blank line, and we're going to send that to Ways and Means.
It's
and get
in
some
the
money.
Governor's budget with $5 million. So.
Okay. Any questions for?
Oh, quick.
Yeah, Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just quickly, I don't have the report in front of me right now, but give us a positive projection once we get the $5 million. How many jobs are we looking at potentially? Is there a way to calculate that, or is it too early?
This would thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam. Thank you for the excellent question. It'd be a little too early to add a job projection here, because the intent is to support early technologies and commercialization of new products. So once they test out, then they'll hopefully create jobs. They will create jobs, but the time frame might not be within a couple of years. Sir,
I understand, Mr. Chair. It's very encouraging and positive program. I'm eager to see how many we can create with this kind of incentive.
Any further questions? Okay, seeing none, I'll close the public hearing. Do you, can you send this, Mike? Mm-hmm. Get it, send this to Ways and Means now, or do you want to wait?
Yeah, no.
Okay.
Chair Clem, I move House Bill 2434A to the floor with a...
Sorry, one second. Let me open a work session on House Bill 2434A.
All right. Chair Clem, I move House Bill 2434A to the floor with a due pass recommendation that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Vice Chair Post moves House Bill 2434A to the floor with a due pass recommendation that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? I will just say I'm really pleased at the focus of Business Oregon on these rural communities. I think this is extremely important, and I will be there to help advocate for this in Ways and Means, as will, I'm sure, lots of our committee members. With that, any further discussion? Seeing none, will the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Gilliam.
Aye.
Representative Gomberg.
Aye.
Representative McLean.
Aye.
Representative Witt.
Excused.
Vice Chair Helm?
Aye.
Vice Chair Post?
Aye.
Chair Klein?
Aye. Motion passes. The bill is sent to Ways and Means. Now then, Representative Widener could not be here today, so he has some comments in the record. But, Senator, are you here on some of the federal lands bills? Why don't you join us, and we're going to try and get Representative Wilson here eventually. One of them says, but I think we're at 2 or...
He'll be here at 1:30.
Yeah. Well, why don't you join us, Senator, since you're here.
Thank you.
And tell us about them, and then we'll have the sponsor of one when he can get here, and the other one won't be able to be here today.
Are they open?
Widening. Oh, yeah. Let me open public hearings on House Bill 3444, HJM 13, and House Bill 3240, in case you want to comment on any of them at any point.
Thank you, Chair Clay, members of the committee. And I want to really thank you for hearing these bills. They are so very important to rural Oregon. For the record, I'm Senator Doug Whitsett. I represent most of 5 south-central rural counties: Klamath, Lake, Crook, Deschutes, Jackson. One only needs to drive across our beautiful state to witness the gross mismanagement of the lands currently under federal control. Land under private management generally shows the care of pride of ownership. Forests are thin, ground fuels are minimized, range land is managed for sustainable use, fields are tilled and noxious weeds are controlled. This is not the case with land under federal control. Federal lands can be easily identified simply by driving by. Timber is diseased and dying. Ground and ladder fuels have been allowed to proliferate. Noxious weeds are everywhere and spreading. And the result is a dead and dying landscape in wait of the spark that will set off yet another wildfire holocaust. The state is scarred with the aftermath of ever larger wildfires, virtual holocausts that are the direct result of failed federal management. And not only do we have the problem in the fires on the federal lands, too many of these fires are starting on the federal lands and coming out and wiping out our private lands as well. There's little you can do, Mr. Chair, when a wildfire is up in the trees half a mile wide and it crosses over the border from the federal land to the private land. It's a mess. Lands under Forest Service and Bureau of Land Management control used to be self-sustaining. They were historically, they were major cash producers. Under current failed federal care, these entities are cash sumps that now cost significantly more to mismanage than they do when they actually produce. The ever-increasing and ludicrously high cost of federal wildfire suppression utilizes most of the discretionary funds that the agency should be using for resource management. The downward spiral appears to have no sight and end. The bloated bureaucracies that control these lands appear incapable of change. Literally thousands of federal employees spend virtually all of their time in federal office cubicles managing paperwork rather than managing public resources. Even the vehicles in their parking lots are pristine, shiny, and clean. Mr. Chair, we visited a BLM and Forest Service compound in Southern Oregon end of last summer, toward the end of the fire season. And I was amazed that there were over 275 employees in that complex, all of them in cubicles about twice the size of this desk with a computer and so forth. And when I say the shiny vehicles, when I left that building, I spent about half an hour walking around. There wasn't a dirty vehicle in the lot. And farmers and ranchers and foresters, generally, you can't see your face in the shine, That's my point. We know that our state agencies are able to do a much better job of managing the lands because they have already shown that capability. We must return public lands to productivity. The tax base in our rural counties is always grossly reduced because, for instance, Lake County, over 80% of that county is owned by the federal government. There is no tax base return there. There's a little bit of grazing, whatever the federal government chooses to allow, but the tax base is devastated by the ownership of federal property, and that's across the state of Oregon. Well over half the state of Oregon is owned by the federal government. In my opinion, the only viable way to do that, to return our lands to productivity is to return the ownership of the lands to the states, where it actually belongs. All states were admitted to the Union under equal footing, under equal states' rights. Those rights include the transfer of the ownership of most lands to the states. That has not occurred in most of the Rocky Mountain and Western states, and fairness requires that the federal lands in these states be created and treated in the same manner as all of the other states, whether this is accomplished by legislation or through the courts ultimately. Mr. Chair, committee members, please move these bills to the House floor for a vote. They're really, I think, critical for rural parts of Oregon.
Thank you. Any questions for the Senator? All right. Seeing none, thank you for coming over.
Thank you very much, Chair.
And maybe we'll just come back to Representative Wilson when he gets here. So why don't I just start with, how about Cape? Well, let me see if I got from over 100 miles. Lieutenant Robert Powell. Yeah. And for those visiting us, we try and let people who've come over 100 miles go first. Is there anybody else here to testify who's from over 100 miles away from Salem? Okay, so Robert, I'm going to have you go ahead in just a second, but then I'll just go down the list. Kay Bridges and Bob Soudan, come on up and join us. Go ahead, Mr.
Yes, Representative Plam, thank you, and the chair, and the rest of the representatives today. My name is Luke. Can you hear me?
Yeah, but you can back up because that was not
Sorry,
for hearing
that better?
You. That's for the tape.
I apologize.
It's okay.
My name is Lieutenant Robert Powell, and I am a retired military analyst and a citizen who ancestors have been here since the 1840s. And my grandfather owned the Deepwood House, which you guys as a city now maintain. Mm-hmm. And I'm speaking to the transfer of public lands because the quality of our life has been diminished essentially by the federal government owning the lands. So I'm going to speak about one specific issue, and I noticed in the testimony from the Tuesday that there are a lot of people testifying who really have no skin in the game. And in the attorney's rules, usually you look at the court system in having some standing, and when you're looking at transferring lands from the federal government to the state, there needs to be some due attention to the fact that citizens are the ones who are pushing and trying to gain the property back for their own survival. So today I'm going to speak as Democratic Senator Thomas Hart Benton. And he said that the federal government became the monopolizer of vacant lands of the West. And this monopoly, like all monopolies, has resulted in hardships to those whom it acted upon. Now, Democratic Senator Thomas Hart Benton, you might not know about, but President Roosevelt wrote a 372-page biography of this man because he was so revered in the Congress. And he was from the state of Missouri, and he retrieved his federal land, the land that was owned. 90% of Missouri was owned by the federal government, and he retrieved it for the state of Missouri. And the Western states today really are engaged in the same fight to shake off the same federal monopolizer of Western lands, and that is resulting in the hardship. Let me give you a couple of specific examples. There are 16 counties in our state who are effectively bankrupt. Either the state of Oregon is granting them and funding them, or they're just simply bankrupt. I just came back from Wheeler County, who just had 25% of their revenue removed by a fire. So their timber revenue is gone, and the Sierra Club is actively pushing against them to even salvage what is left. And so when I say there's people who don't have the skin in the game, I hope you will take that under respect, but understand what I'm trying to say. Secondly, the U.S. Supreme Court reiterated the foundational doctrine that the constitutional quality of the states is essential to the harmonious operation of this republic. And we are a republic, not a democracy. And that our nation was and is a union of states equal in dignity, power and authority. The states actually own the federal government. Most people don't know what the Constitution really says. Restrictive federal regulations and counterproductive management policies stifle local control and self-government. As a result, public access to the federally controlled land is restricted, the health of our lands and forests suffer, and hundreds of billions of dollars in revenues that could come to employees of the state, because you could run it better than the federal government, we could get rid of half of those 247 vehicles that were sitting in Mr. Witsit's parking lot, and then use Oregon vehicles if we have to. The last thing I would like to pass on about this is Senator Barton was doing this in 1829. He knew then that the federal government was not capable of managing these lands. And what we have are the basically the empty suits who have no skin in the game trying to pressure you into keeping things in a different position than is today. The surrounding western states, Illinois, Arkansas, Louisiana, and Florida, joined together with Missouri in demanding that Congress transfer title to the public lands. They argued that without the ability to manage their own resources, western states were at a totally economic disadvantage. In addition, if eastern states had stewardship over their lands, what authority did the national government have to deny this right on terms of equality to the western states? So, this went on from 1823 to 1836. And so, as a result, Missouri has gotten its lands back. Now, I want to testify specifically, just for a moment, because I know we are short of time, to the fact that the Federal Paperwork Reduction Act in 1994 allowed the Sierra Club to suck millions of dollars out of the taxpayers' payroll, because it was a combination of an agreement between the federal government and the Sierra Club that they would be able to sue the federal government and the federal government would pay. Unfortunately, the federal government is broke, and we do not have the funds to deal with some of this, and so it's a natural opportunity to bring revenue back. Wheeler County is basically totally bankrupt because they lost 25% of their income. I don't know which of you wants to lose 25% of your salary, but the people out there are dying. And so we have to start respecting them. And it's not unconstitutional, as some of these groups that testified on Tuesday have said, to get the land back. Absolutely not. What we need is further addressment of this issue. We cannot wing this. This is a very serious issue for Oregon, and we must pay attention to it. And I, frankly, as a military analyst, have more material, but I didn't bring it because, frankly, it's a very busy day every day here. But all of you on the committee have my name, and I will give her my paperwork. And I've studied this for about 15 years. So I will be more than happy to assist you, and I hope you will take that advice. And I do appreciate you all very much. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for driving so far to join us today. Kay and Bob.
Thank you. Chairman Clement, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Bob Soden from Cottage Grove. I'm a citizen analyst for the Oregon Citizens Lobby. I support the passing of legislation that returns federal lands back to the state. Oregon is a unique state that deserves to be protected and preserved for the future generations, and best served when we have a say in how they are preserved. Oregon also has vast resources when managed responsibly, will benefit Oregonians that are lost by mismanagement at the federal level for schools and public safety. Public lands belong to the citizens of the states which the lands reside. With 52.3% of the land mass in federal hands, I believe that local control and management of lands by the state is more preferable, as they have a fiduciary responsibility to generate revenues from state trust lands, while the federal land agencies have conflicting regulations that overlap and often lack a clear mandate, which is clear in the fact of forest management practices that have resulted in catastrophic wildfires and tremendous loss of revenue to the state by not maintaining a sustainable timber harvest. States generate more revenue per dollar spent than the federal government on a variety of land management activities, including timber, grazing, minerals, and recreation. With the lands under state management, it will provide jobs as the federal positions will be filled with state as determined by a task force, that's HB 3244, that will consider how land management would have to change in order to generate the revenues under state control. Citizen involvement will be at the local level that will hold 90 state legislators accountable. We're under federal management. There are 528 legislators with only 7 legislators represent Oregon interests. I'm very concerned about the public safety issue where the rural communities are desperate for funds as the federal government have not fulfilled their agreements in making payments, leaving the rural communities without funding for schools and sheriff protection, where the state will set priorities to the needs of Oregonians. One of those concerns that is the sale of federal lands to pay off debt. As Ecuador sold land to China to pay off some of their debt, I would ask, who do you trust as owning lands in Oregon when we in Oregon have to balance our budget with a federal government that does not? I thank you for your time and consideration to support the transfer of public lands in Oregon.
Thank you, Bob. Kay?
Chair Clem and committee, my name is Kay Bridges. I spent most of my time since 1952 in high school in Newburgh and Yamhill County, and then the rest of my life raising my family in Washington County. When I came here and went to high school in Newburgh a long time ago, I'm 78. 1952, I was aghast when I found out that my students, co-students, the students in my classes, didn't even know the history of the Tillamook Burn. They hadn't seen any of the forestry films. I had been fascinated by them back in Maryland. And I had seen at least 3, maybe more. And I knew more about the Tillamook Burn than they did. Now, a lot of those people are growing up today. I ended up moving to Chehalem Mountain. Lived there for almost 40 years. It was on the Chehalem Burn, which occurred either just before or just after Tillamook. I honestly don't remember which. When we logged it after living there for 25 years, when they came to cruise the timber, they said, you know this is planted land. And I'm going, oh my gosh, when I was in high school, I planted trees on Chehalem Mountain. I might have even planted the trees I harvested. I studied really hard about harvesting trees and understanding the rural community, and I saw what the timber industry was like here in Oregon. And it's gone. What I remember when I came to Oregon is gone. And we need to control our lands here in the state of Oregon again in order to control our timber. That's very important. We had one tree that lasted the burn, a fir tree this big, and when we cleared out around it, it grew again. They tried to say we didn't replant enough down by the creek. I said, alder is the tree of choice by a creek, fir won't grow there. I understand your timber industry. Then I went to work for the title companies. After that, I was a florist for 25 years. But in the title companies, I started teaching classes to realtors about how Section 16 and 36 out of every township, every 36 square miles, was designated by the federal government, land ordinance of 1785 and subsequent changes. The Surveyor General was advised how to create those townships, and I was a title officer for over 12 of the 14 years. Subnote, the first woman in the Tri-County area who was appointed a title officer in the title companies who was not an attorney, and I was training attorneys and reading the ORS. I handled a patent, a land patent on a piece of ground, a little triangle out in Beaverton, that had not been conveyed properly from the federal government, and hand carried President Clinton's signature on a land patent. My question today is, What happened to all of our land? What happened to Section 16 and 36 and the western part of Oregon, eastern part of Oregon? I'm sorry, I'm from Maryland, and the ocean is always over there. I do it instinctively all the time. Sorry. What happened? I looked up on the website, state website, and the state school fund lands have almost nothing left due to certain numerous numbers of circumstances. I'm going, I want to know what they are. Because I'm still wondering if the conveyance, if the chain of title that supposedly the federal government claims now is really accurate. So I want our lands back and whatever it takes to do it. And I will volunteer, as he said, my time to do that. I will submit an email testimony because I was here all day yesterday and then in Albany and then back again and here I am again. I will submit an email as soon as I leave this room today. I taught realtors about that. I said, guess what school in Washington County is still in Section 16? Beaverton High School. So I taught the kids at Beaverton High School also. I know there can be discrepancies, and I know there are loopholes. And American Lands Council, along with people like myself, may be able to cure this debacle. And Oregon can have its land back, and they can manage it like I manage that 36 acres federal small woodlot, where you only pay the taxes when you cut the timber. We cut the timber, select log, windfall log, full clear cut, full replanting. The state of Oregon and the people in this state know how to manage those lands better than the federal government back in D.C. that I visited last year. And I beg you to pursue every possible avenue to have the state of Oregon controlling the rest of its land. Thank you, committee.
Thank you. And I neglected to really start with the people who were here last week, so I apologize for that. So I am going to ask where is Representative Wilson, the sponsor of our bill, and Commissioner Smith from Clackamas County, and maybe not last week, it was earlier this week, sorry. And then how about Janice Deisinger, if you hear her? Then I'm going to switch to a panel of three that are not in favor. I just grabbed the one that was yellow, and I realized I should have probably started with the people who were here before for sure. So, Representative Wilson, do you want to tell us a little bit about at least your two of these? You might be on all three of them, but at least two of the three you've introduced.
Thank you, Chair Clem. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. I'd like to talk about a couple of these, HJM 13 and House Bill 3240, which actually would establish a task force on the federal land ownership in Oregon, which I think is a great place to start. But beginning today with HJM 13, when I first became aware of what was going on here in the United States by seeing a very simple map that showed me very, very colorfully that from Colorado eastward, almost all the lands are in public hands or that of the various states. And then compared that to what I saw west of the Rockies, where most of the West is owned by the federal government, it made it very easy for me to get involved in this situation, primarily because my county, Josephine County, is 68% owned by the federal government. Now, you know, our problems that we currently have are very graphic. People talk about us all the time. They realize what trouble that we're in Josephine County. We are very close to losing our jail again soon. You ask, well, what's the matter with those people down there? Why don't they support public safety? They have ample opportunity to do so. But the problem is that we have never recovered from losing our natural resource-based economy, and we're continuing to struggle to catch up. Our problem is that we're very land poor, with 68% of our county owned by the federal government, and generally we receive nothing from them. We have a very, very small tax base. We have a base of beleaguered taxpayers who are being asked to do more all the time, and it is getting to be more difficult all the time. And so the trajectory that we're on is fairly predictable, given what's going on. As I go around the state, and I spend a lot of time on motorcycle all over this state, in fact, all over the country, I'm amazed when I see the beauty of the state and the tremendous resources that we have. And I always say to myself as I go out there in the hinterlands, wouldn't it be a beautiful situation if Oregonians were in charge of what we can see? We know from previous testimony that the federal government does not do a very good job of maintaining the stewardship of our lands here in Oregon, over 50% being stewarded by the federal government. The fires that we're having are just catastrophic, and they're becoming almost a yearly thing. And I have a very, very strong feeling that if we had a situation where Oregonians were stewarding Oregon and exercising that stewardship over all we see around here, we would find that our situation would begin to improve. As we look at what has happened in history, there was a time when the eastern states were primarily owned by the federal government. We see that they petitioned, and they were successful. They had an opportunity to receive that land from the federal government and began to put it in private ownership, state ownership, and began to prosper. They don't have the difficulties back there funding the basic public services that we do here in the West. And it's really no small wonder why we have such a difficulty here in the West being primarily owned by the federal government. And again, the federal government is not very good at compensating us for that land. And so thank you again. I appreciate the fact that you're hearing this today. Everybody will be making some great points. It's just my privilege to bring this forward. It's very easy for me to do that, given the fact that my own home county is 68% owned by someone else. So again, thank you for hearing this today. We just appreciate you hosting a group of good people who have a lot of great things to say about this movement. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Commissioner.
Thank you, Clem, Chair Clem, and members of the committee, and also thanks to Representatives Wilson and Escoval for bringing these issues forward today to start a dialogue about the ownership of our federal lands. If you could only remember two numbers today, I encourage you to remember 52 and 65. Clackamas County is Oregon's third largest county, yet the federal government owns 52% of our land mass in our timberland. As a member of Metro Regional Government, completing the trifecta of Washington and Multnomah County, our job recovery rate hovers around 65% of pre-recession job loss, while Multnomah County and Washington County have recovered over 100%. Again, 52% of our federal lands, and again, 65% pre-recession job loss. Unfortunately, today we are at an impasse in an active forest management. Changes in forest management, or lack thereof, and natural resource policies coupled with constricting litigation have led to dramatic declines in our timber harvest. Since 1990, Clackamas County lost 12 mills, totaling hundreds, if not thousands, of full-time family wage jobs. Again, 52 and 65. Clackamas County is home to Oregon's richest city, Lake Oswego, and home to some of the highest poverty rates as well in the South County where our timber base lies. We are a true representation of Oregon's demographics. We escaped a bullet last fall with the 36 pit fire at Estacada coming within city limits. As a county, we evacuated residents, moved livestock, and kept property loss at a minimum while the fire burned for 2 months, awaiting the winter rains to put it out. And reminder, Clackamas County and no county in this state is equipped to fight forest fires. The only thing that we can do is find housing for residents if they're burned out. However, this lack of active management with the low snowpack and hotter condition is resulting in more frequent forest fires. 40% of Oregon's forests are now at a high risk of catastrophic forest fire. In 2013 alone, Oregon spent an extra $40 million to suppress wildfires. The federal government is also allocating higher sums to combat fires throughout the West, but yet something has to change. Rather than focusing on the symptoms, we should be striving to solve the root of the problem so that we can once again harness the true potential of our forests. Thoughtful management of our forest lands will mean fewer fires, more jobs, and more funds to help counties manage pressing priorities such as their roads, or the state government filling the state school fund with timber revenues. House Bill 3240 puts us on the right track by studying a host of questions that are key to better understanding the idea of transferring federal lands to the state. Quite simply, the bill starts a process that could ultimately lead to an end in the current impasse. Clackamas County supports the creation of a task force to study the issue. As a statewide leader in forest management practices, I would also request the addition of two county governing body members on the task force to ensure that the local perspective is reflected in discussions. Thank you once again. I urge you to pass 3240.
Thank you. And Janice?
Yeah, I have that.
Chair Klim and Vice Chair Helm and Post, I want to thank you for and members for the opportunity to speak. Am I all right with the microphone here? I prepared different testimony for the different bills, so I'll try to summarize them up together for you. I just am excited about this time in our state's history where we can fulfill some of our founders' original dreams about the state and providing for our resources here to be used to take care of our citizens. In the process of going through these different bills, I think you'll find the American Lands Council is a great resource for you. And as the map that Representative Wilson was talking about is represented here. And why the difference between the East and the West, and you'll see the red is where the federal lands are owned. And if you look on the front of the other card, you might try to overlap those maps and you will see where the federal land is owned. You also see the second map shows where all the forest fires are. And on the third map, you see where the minerals are owned. And you see that we have such great resources. This is a wonderful, exciting time to be alive in Oregon and on the West. And all of these states are undergoing these same considerations right now and asking for their lands back. So the American Lands Council, I think, will be a great resource for you to view. I have just an opening video I wanted to show you.
Imagine dialing 911 and the voice on the other end says, "Sorry, due to budget cuts, no one can help you."
We'll grow a controversy over budgets and public safety after an Oregon woman's call to 911 goes unanswered.
Well, that's the reality for tens of thousands of people in rural Oregon. Many counties in the state have cut public safety budgets due to the loss of vital timber payments. That's money from the federal government paid to counties with large national forests. In other words, land that can't be taxed.
Josephine County, in the southwest corner of Oregon, was probably the hardest hit. The sheriff's department lost more than half of its funding. As a result, deputies no longer respond to emergency calls in the evenings or on the weekends. Calls like this one, made just last August.
I don't have anybody to send out there.
Obviously if he comes inside the residence and assaults you, can you ask him to go away or, you know, if he's intoxicated or anything? I probably asked him, I've already told him I was calling you, he's spoken before, but he's at my door and insulted me.
Is there any way you can safely leave the residence?
No, I can't, because he's blocking pretty much down the way out.
Well, the only thing I can do is give you some advice and call the sheriff's office tomorrow. Obviously, if he comes in and unfortunately has a weapon or is trying to cause you physical harm, that's a different story. The sheriff's office doesn't work up there. I don't have anybody to send.
According to police records, a few minutes later, the woman's ex-boyfriend, Michael Bella, used a piece of metal to pry open her front door. He then attacked her. Eventually, state police arrested him, and he pleaded guilty to sexual assault and sodomy, among other charges.
He broke into her home, and he raped her.
But a lot of the policing in this area was paid for by federal money that helped subsidize the area because there's a lot of federal lands there. So part of
their main industry is timber, and we were subsidizing that, but then we took it away.
And there are federal lands that you can't tax because the federal government owns the land, and so they instead subsidize it, and that helped pay for public services. So this is a direct result of some of the cuts that we're seeing in the federal government.
There isn't a day go by that we don't have another victim.
That's Josephine County Sheriff Gilbertson. He sent out a press release. In it, he warned victims of domestic violence to, quote, consider relocating to an area with adequate law enforcement services.
There's absolutely no consequences to committing a crime today, given the fact that law enforcement is as weak as it is.
For years, Millett says, federal timber payments funded good public safety in this county. They also kept local tax rates low.
People's lives really are at stake. This should not have happened. This is tragic.
And get back to the other ones. I'm not sure I know how to do that here.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
If I might just mention something, back in the 80s, I was a reserve deputy with Josephine County, and those were back in the years when we did have a very successful natural resource-based economy. And for every one of our shifts at the sheriff's office, we had at least 4 road deputies going out, and I mean every shift. And we were hopping from call to call in a county that is much smaller then than it is now. And we were putting as much as 150, 200 miles a night on our cars on every shift. And I say just going from call to call. That's back when Josephine County had a population of probably 50,000. Now we have virtually no sheriff patrols. The jail is sometimes open, sometimes closed. And it's just kind of an incredible slide that we've seen over time. So once again, we draw a line directly back to the federal ownership and the fact that any reliable income stream that comes from there is dubious. Thank you.
Great.
As you can see, if I may finish it, I'll be quick.
Okay.
These issues are. I had another video, but you can watch that on from it's linked in my testimony, and I wanted to point out. If this land remains with the federal government as the controller, they will receive 95% of the income that comes from that, regardless if they sell it or we sell it. But if we have ownership of it in title, then we will get to decide who gets that land. And by Oregon owning that, it will keep the incentive to not sell it. So that land is safer with us, and we'll be able to control who our neighbors are. The Supreme Court already ruled in the state with Hawaii in their public lands back in 2009 that the Congress must transfer the land back to the, it's their solemn duty to transfer it back to the states. So we have, what an exciting time that we are living in and that you have opportunity to fulfill the dreams of our founders. I guess I'll just sum that all up and thank you very much for your time.
Okay, thank you for coming. Okay, let me ask.
I thought maybe Commissioner Smith.
Commissioner Smith, could you try and field the question that we were going to ask Representative Wilson, but he left?
I'll try.
Vice Chair Post.
Thank you, Chair Clem. Commissioner, I'm
one of the arguments that I hear about this is, oh, the state of Oregon, if they got it all back, they wouldn't be able to deal with it. They wouldn't be able to handle it. They couldn't mm-hmm. afford to mm-hmm. maintain it. And there's a lot of that going on. How would you answer that?
Representative Clem, Representative Post, I would answer it like that. Gee, I wish we had that problem. As you know, right now, the state forests, they're upside down in their budget. They are not cutting enough trees. They are, because they claim they don't have the resources. This would give them ample resources. I worked on this bill for 9 months with the Association of Oregon Counties, and we explored and debated every possible issue that could be done on this, and we decided to go with a study. My initial goal with this is the chain of title would have to go from the federal government to the state government and then to the counties. I think the land should be turned over to the counties. Right now in Clackamas County, we own 3,000 acres of our own timberland. We manage it for sustainable purposes. You could draw a line at our county-managed land that sits next to the federal forest lands, and like some of our people that spoke earlier, there's a huge demarcation in the type of land. We use that revenue off of our timberlands. We don't cut any trees over 50 years old. It's on a sustainable yield basis, and we use that money to pay off things and sustain our parks in Clackamas County. Just this last year, we paid off a debt of $5 million on a golf course. The revenues of that golf course will now be used to supplement our other parks. So with the creation of this work group and task force, ideas like this will come forward. The creation of the task force, in essence, will bring all ideas to the table to see what's doable.
All right, just one small follow-up. I'm sorry. I got it.
Okay. Follow-up.
Well, I was gonna hammer Rep. Wilson with this stuff.
I know, but
you got a lot
there.
Of people to talk. But I have a fear about this, and this is my fear, that tomorrow all of this land came back. The state of Oregon mm-hmm. is hamstrung now and can't harvest the timber that I would like to see harvested because of lawsuits, environmental groups, whatever it might be. So let's say we all get it back tomorrow. Who's to say we'll actually be able to use it?
Create a task force, appoint people who will do the job. There's a lot to be done. I would suggest that you not operate out of fear, but operate instead of out of what's possible and how great a state this can be if we manage our natural resources properly. I think that fear is unfounded, but I understand it because I've heard it before. The county governments, Josephine County, some of these governments would love the opportunity to manage their lands. I asked our county forester, I says, Rick, if we got a bunch of this land back, we manage it properly? He says, give it to me and I cannot wait. So I think there are people out there and we're not using those resources.
I think I've got. Let me try this one. I think this will answer your question. The county and the state all have to manage under the same exact laws that the federal government does. So the ability to produce more harvest and more revenue under the same legal structure mm-hmm. Is evidenced by current harvest levels on county-owned timberland, state-owned timberland, and federally-owned timberland.
Well, I'll put one caveat to that. If Oregon lands are managed according to the Oregon Forest Practices Act, when the ownership comes back to Oregon, we are no longer subject to lawsuits in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in San Francisco. Our lawsuits become local. They go to judges in Oregon who are elected by the people or supposedly elected by the people. Yeah, we could still have environmental lawsuits, but they would be within the state.
I'm going to ask the next group about that because I think we still have to manage under the Endangered Species Act and NEPA.
Well, there's an Endangered Species Act, but it's also Oregon Forest Practices Act. And I would submit the questions that you're asking today are the questions that we've vetted at AOC, and those same questions would be asked during the task force, and they're very good.
Excellent. Thank you. Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Rhett, Jim, and Tom, can you come up? And Representative Witt, while they're...
Mr. Chairman, while they're coming up, would you consider requesting an informal opinion from LC, the basis upon which federal lands would revert to state ownership?
Yes. I'm fairly certain, for example, the line that says they shall return it by a certain date is probably not allowed. But
it's a map.
But I can.
Here you guys. This might be SEIU in reverse. They always stand in the bathroom.
I'm not sure we're allowed to receive gifts even.
Could you give them to Lindsay right here, off to the side?
Okay, Lindsay, thank you. But they show the map of the United States.
I hope it's worth less than 30 cents.
We, depending on their value, we may have to redonate those to some other groups. We'll see. Okay,
and
gentlemen, thank you for waiting 72 hours to testify. So whoever would like to start, I've got different ones of you in different positions on different signups. So
I can start. Chair Clem, members of the committee, my name is Rhett Lawrence. I'm the conservation director for the Oregon chapter of the Sierra Club. I have submitted written testimony, so I'm not going to walk through all of that. I just wanted to hit a couple of high points and then respond to a couple of points that have been made already. I did want to say, first of all, that obviously currently these are public lands owned by all Americans who should have a say in how they're being managed. You know, these are recreational spots, drinking water sources, hunting and fishing spots, wildlife habitat. All of these uses would be constrained if we shifted to more extractive uses of the land. I think that's fairly evident. And then to your point, Chair Clem, I think it is the case that the federal environmental laws don't go away when these lands are transferred either to the state or to counties. We would still have to comply with the Endangered Species Act, Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act. All federal laws would still apply. You know, I think there's some question whether the National Environmental Policy Act (NEPA) would apply, and so there would potentially be fewer opportunities for direct challenges to some timber sales, for instance. But by the same token, public input in how these lands are managed would be lessened if NEPA goes away as well. And so, just in closing, I think to Representative Post's point too, I think there is a substantial question about how the state would have the money to manage all these lands. In some of the information I submitted to the committee, an extensive study from the University of Utah Law School, they passed a similar law in Utah last year, looked at some of the impacts around the country, and referenced an opinion from the state of Idaho that the cost of managing those lands is going to in Idaho exceed any potential revenue they could get off it, given current the current state of the laws. So and again, we don't have the staff or the budgets at the state agencies as it is to manage the lands that we do have currently, much less adding even more to the to their responsibilities. So with that, I'll close, turn it over to my colleagues here, and be happy to answer any questions.
Chair Clem, committee members, for the record, my name is Tom Wolf, the executive director of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited, representing the 3,000 Oregonians that make up Trout Unlimited here in the state. We are a group of hunters and fishers that recreate. I would say that when we do our hunting and fishing, roughly 90% of the time here in Oregon, we're doing that on federal lands. And as was brought up by Red, and it's in my written testimony that was submitted to OLIST, the state agencies here in the state of Oregon are not set up with the kind of staffing you need to deal with the recreational needs, the fishery biologists, all the positions that are now on federal land. You know, currently, the management at the things like fishery biologists, management for trails and things like that at the different state agencies are either very, very minuscule or non-existent. So you're going to take federal lands, put them in the state, and incur large costs and possibly take away the rights of Oregonians to recreate, to hike, to fish, to enjoy those woods. And let's also point out that a Dean Runyon report done in 2009 for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife points out that fishing, hunting, and wildlife viewing alone bring $2.5 billion into the state of Oregon. That money that goes to restaurants, to hotels, to gas stations in rural communities. If you take that, if you transfer that to state land, they're not set up to manage that. They're not set up to provide that same sort of recreation for the rural communities. So we have to be very careful here. I mean, I understand sincerity of the people that testified before me. I, too, am a sixth-generation Oregonian whose family came over in the 1840s. My family still farms up in western Washington County. So I understand the concern people have, but this is not the answer. I ask that HJM 13, HB 3240, and HB 344 not advance from this committee because they are the wrong bills. Thank you.
Jim.
Good afternoon, Chair Clem and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jim Myron, and I'm here representing the Native Fish Society. I'll be brief. I won't try and repeat anything that my colleagues have stated, but we, too, are opposed to the idea that federal land should be transferred to the state. And just speaking strictly from the fish perspective, which is our main issue, right now federal lands manage timber harvest along streams with a lot stricter rules than currently apply under the State Forest Practices Act. So we think this would be a huge loss for fish if you transferred ownership and manage those lands in the future under the FPA instead. So thank you.
Questions? Vice Chair Post.
Quick question for Tom. Tom, okay, I'm just trying to understand because I fish and hunt a lot. So if today the stream that I was wading down or floating down and fishing is federal, if this act, these things happen tomorrow and it became state, all of a sudden, I can't fish there anymore.
I'm not saying that. I'm saying that in order to manage those lands, whether it's provide fishery biologists for the streams to make sure that the habitat's good, whether it's provide recreational opportunities like campgrounds and things like that, those we don't have the infrastructure within the state agencies to manage that. So you'd lose out on that. That's what I'm saying. I'm not saying you wouldn't be able to do it. I'm just saying that the infrastructure that exists within the federal government is not in our state agencies.
It wouldn't affect, I guess what I'm getting at is, so I wouldn't have a place to camp, maybe, or a water spigot, but I can still fish there.
Yeah, you could still fish there, but you'd also, for example, the vast majority of fishery biologists in this state that do active land management are federal. ODFW, the fish for biologists, they're not set up to do habitat work. That's not their responsibilities. The state, the BLM, the Federal Forest Service, they provide the fishery biologists that actually make sure that there's fish for you to catch in those streams that we're just talking about. So you're not going to have those biologists unless the state spends a lot more money to hire people to do that. That will cost more money for the infrastructure. So that's all I'm saying. And so technically, yes, you'd still be able to fish there if they were state lands, but I'd be honest in saying that the fishing wouldn't be as good.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We've heard testimony that I think would lead to the conclusion, or could lead to a conclusion, that one of the main purposes of this ownership reversion back to the state would be for increased revenue. We've also heard testimony that these lands would optimally go to county management, and that under county management, certain federal laws would not govern the use of those lands. Were we to lose multiple use of all of these lands, how would that impact hunting, fishing, camping, the public's access to these lands if we lost multiple use and the emphasis was commodity-based production off of these lands?
Chair Clem, Representative Witt, just let me speak to that. As I said before, the vast majority of places that people hunt and recreate in is federal land, and if we were to lose multiple use on those federal lands, people that hunt and fish would be denied that ability. I mean, for example, I'd say that you'd lose the ability to fish on BLM land on the Deschutes, Forest Service land on the Clackamas, Forest Service land on the Rogue, if they were put into county management that didn't allow multiple use. So it would be devastating.
Chair Clement, Representative Wood, if I could briefly respond to him. And I think you're exactly right. And I think the other point, too, is that, you know, as I stated earlier, given the current, you know, regime of laws that operate, I mean, I do think the same environmental laws would apply, whether county ownership, state ownership, federal. I think it's the case that it is the case that if we start managing these hunting and fishing spots, hiking areas, you know, as purely extractive purposes, you know, timber production zones, then public access is going to be lost. You know, those fishing spots are going to be compromised. I agree with Tom that we would see a real loss in recreational opportunities for Oregonians.
Thank you.
Representative McLean.
Yeah. Assuming the locals are not the buffoons that you imply, assuming state people can manage budgets, receive educations, assuming county and state officials prioritize access for recreational use, do you believe that we are capable of administration in order to be comparable to the federal government in its administration?
Who wants that one? Chair Clem, Representative McLean, I certainly think we're capable. Well, no. I mean,
no, I'm not talking about you.
Right.
Oregon. I'm talking about Oregonians.
As am I, Representative McLean.
I don't consider the Sierra Club to be on the same footing as Josephine County, because you guys aren't enduring what they're enduring.
Representative, let's let him answer.
So, Chair Clem, Representative McLean, given that, I think Oregonians are capable of managing those lands however we want to. I would return to the point that there are, you know, currently, you know, environmental constraints in place that wouldn't go away just because of a transfer of federal land, that are still going to, apply no matter who the owner is.
One final question.
Follow up. Did you have something?
Are the habitats that you gentlemen are here today to protect, or at least to advocate for, hurt by forest fires?
Chair Clem, Representative McLean, and Jim Myron again. I'm not an expert on forest fires, but obviously forest fires do some damage. And in certain instances, they improve the habitat over time by freeing up a lot of things. I'm not an expert on that issue. But on the question of whether Oregonians are capable, certainly they are. They're capable also of upgrading the Forest Practices Act and bringing it into the 21st century. But the question is, are we willing?
Chair Clem, Representative McLean, like I said, I'm a sixth generation. Certainly, they're capable of it. That's the problem is not that they're individually capable, but is, are we as the state agencies or county agencies, that's a huge burden to be asked to do, and that's basically an unfunded mandate. As far as the forest fire issue goes, truly they're devastating, but also for example, if you look at the Yellowstone fires that happened in the late 1980s, they did cause great harm, but they eventually caused benefit. And I'm not saying that we should not fight them or stop catastrophic ones, but to say that, I mean, right now, the state forest people and other, you know, and other agencies are looking more and more to prescribe fires. So our ecosystems grew up with fires. We've stopped that cycle. And some people, some professional forces could say that stopping that cycle has accelerated the catastrophic fires. So I'm not a forester. And so will the state or county governments do a better job with forest fires? I don't know. Maybe they will. I don't know. But I'm just saying that are they set up to manage the forests in the same manner that the federal government does for recreational purposes? And my answer to that is no.
Representative Gomberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just for clarification, I'm a little confused at where we are. Is the topic of this hearing include the Resolution 13?
It does. All the bills are open.
All right. Well, I have a question. I'm not sure where to direct it, but the Sierra Club's as good a place to start as any. I'm reading the resolution, and it talks about the fact that we want to cede federal lands except for parks, except for Native American territories, and wilderness areas. Does that mean that we're asking the federal government to cede us the Hanford Reserve?
Chair Clem, Representative Gomberg, I believe that's in Washington.
Thankfully,
obviously there are plenty of of federal lands in the state of Oregon, you know, Forest Service land, BLM land that are you know, great recreational spots that are not national parks or national monuments or those other categories you just mentioned, in which we also think should stay in federal ownership.
Okay, I've got three more. Thank you, gentlemen, for coming.
Thank you, Chair.
Gil Riddell, Marianne, and if you were, actually, I'm not even sure if you signed up on the right one. Farm Bureau, were you really interested in testifying on 3444? No, maybe not. And then Jack Esp. Then, relatively quickly, so we can move over to another non-controversial topic of land use.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties. The three documents that have turned in for the record are there before you. The Association of Counties supports House Bill 3240 and House Joint Memorial 13. The topic of federal transfer of its lands to the state has been under active discussion since the state of Utah in 2012. Adopted House Bill 148 that demanded the federal government to extinguish its title to an estimated 20 million acres of federal public lands in the state by December 31st, 2014. You'll note that House Bill 3444 before your committee takes the same approach. AOC formed a subcommittee that worked between August of 2014 and January of this year on the issue. Ultimately, AOC adopted a resolution, which you have in your records, to request the state study the transfer of certain federal lands to the state of Oregon, describes the current conditions of public lands in Oregon, recommends a study by a bicameral and bipartisan committee appointed by the Legislative Assembly that includes two county governing body members, to study the concept in the resolution, and poses questions for the committee to answer. You'll also find in your records, for your information, a survey we did entitled Activities Related to Transfer of Federal Lands to the state and other Western states with large federal ownership. You'll notice, too, that the whereas clauses in both House Bill 3240 and HJM 13 are virtually identical to those of the AOC resolution. House Bill 3240 would, in fact, appoint a task force by legislative leadership. However, it does not include a county member, and we'd ask that if you're going to move this bill that you amend it to do so. Our reasons are that county governing body members have direct and frequent relations with federal field office and leaders of the U.S. Forest Service and Bureau of Land Management, the land management agencies of the federal government, and they also know the land as well as anyone. Since 2005, AOC, representing its 36 counties, has a memorandum of understanding with the two federal land management agencies for early and often communication, informal communication that is called for before policies are opened and published for potential adoption. There's been a long history, as you know, of revenue sharing between the federal government and county governments. Counties are practitioners of cooperating agency status during federal land management planning. And AOC, the Eastern Oregon Counties Association, and the Association of ONC Counties continue to make significant investments in strategic activities in Washington, D.C. to gain reform of federal forest management. And finally, HJM 13 expresses the sentiment of the AOC resolution and deserves support. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Quick question for the committee.
One second.
Mr. Chairman and fellow committee members, my name is Jack Esp. I'm an analyst for the Oregon Citizen Lobby, but in regards to this bill, more importantly, I'm a citizen of Oregon who enjoys the outdoors. I've listened to some of the testimony today, and as far as a lot of it was presented that Oregon isn't ready, Oregon doesn't have the staff, etc., tell me what business that builds up to cover a multitude times of what they're currently doing until they have a contract to do so. You get the contract, then you build your staff up. Now, as far as the recreation, losing the recreation when it comes to Oregon's control, I recently moved over from Eastern Oregon, and going up into the mountains, the Blue Mountains, it happens in the Cascades, a very high percentage of the roads up there to get access to these places to hunt, fish, recreation, hike, are blocked. They're gated. You can't get into that area. It's off limits. They have set the situation that because of whatever is going on in their minds, that area is not suitable for the citizens of the state of Oregon, or for that matter, any other state that's here. I am arguing that the state will gear up to do that. I ask, has there been a financial study done on what revenue would be created if this came under state control versus what the expenses are? I haven't seen it. I haven't heard it presented here. In business, again, I'm a financial manager, so I always look at the finance side of it. Before anything like this needs to be done, which I'm asking you, begging you, to proceed with this process and regain that land for Oregon. But during that process, I think a physical analysis needs to be undertaken and see where we stand. What is the additional needs in order to accomplish this? We deserve it to the citizens of Oregon to take that control of that land back and let them use it, not let it sit up there and go to disease. Remember what happened over on Highway 97, Klamath Falls area, 10, 15 years ago when the beetle moved in there and wiped out that whole area where they were burning everything, cutting down everything. As previously spoken, the state does a much better job than the feds do in controlling insects, obnoxious weeds, things of that nature. I think it is the responsibility of the representatives representing the counties in Oregon, most of them are timber, federal land involvement, to move this bill forward to the floor with a due, all three of these bills for that matter, with a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Great. And final question, Representative Vice Chair Post.
Okay. thank you, Chair Clem. Gil, just a quick question. I know there's three pieces of legislation we're talking about here, so I may have lost it in the confusion. This is purely out of selfish motives because I'm a co-sponsor on 34. 44, was AOC in support of that one?
Mr. Chair, Representative Post, we did not have an opportunity to talk about that particular legislation, but it is the one that would have the state demand the federal government turn its land over to the state. And Utah, you notice the deadline was the end of 2014. Utah is having to do some other things and has received some advice and has proceeded as if it will ultimately be successful. They have their own developed their own planning process and other things. And there was I believe it was Representative McLean who noticed there were certain, no, it was Representative Gomberg, there were certain kinds of federal lands that are not, would not be affected by the demand to extinguish title. And that's been consistent throughout. That's copied from the Utah law. So that's the only comment I have. We have not. We have not.
Official.
Yeah.
Okay. Just a quick follow-up.
Follow-up.
Thank you. This is really, Chair Clement, one of the reasons that I was so excited to be here again and be on this committee is because I knew that we would get a lot of citizens coming here and talking. No offense to the lobby that are here, but you get paid to come here every day and tell us what we should vote on and what we shouldn't vote on. When citizens take the time to come and leave their jobs or whatever it is they're doing to come here and talk about things, I perk up. I get excited, and I want to thank all these folks for coming here. I appreciate it because it's time out of your busy day, and I just want you to know that it means a lot to me. It's why I'm here.
That wasn't a question, sorry.
Oh. I could ask Representative Witt.
That's a good note to end on right there. Thank you all for coming in. We really appreciate your efforts to come and communicate with your government about your desires. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearings on House Bills 3240, HJM 13, and House Bill 3444, and open and... I don't have to open a work session. I'm just going to carry over the work session on House Bill 3169 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3221. Ask Mr. Chandler to come up. One of the paid people who were not that into seeing.
That's right.
So my plan here, because there's not a lot of other excited people on my list, so I'm going to give you about 10 minutes to tell us about this, and then like the remaining 15 will be, I think, mostly just opposed.
People saying why it didn't do that either.
Yeah. If you don't need 15. I don't know if you need 10, but...
And more work sessions.
No. Okay. Yep.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association, here, sans T-shirt, which is probably part of the reason I'm struggling in this session. I have neither T-shirts nor stickers. I'm going to rectify that by the time we bring this bill forward again. Here on House Bill 3221, and I'm going to speak about the concept behind the printed bill, which has been totally, will be, assuming we go to a work session, totally replaced by the -1 amendments, which are on OLIS, and I suspect after talking with some of the other interested parties, end up with a -2 set. This bill is addressing the process set forth in ORS 197-296, which is how we go about establishing and analyzing urban growth boundaries. And really, I put in written testimony, I think you'll be able to ascertain what we're trying to get at with this, but essentially it's pretty simple, I think. And this is a process we worked on many years ago and have continued to work on, tweak, fiddle with, argue about ever since. UGBs in Oregon have to have a 20-year supply of buildable land. Both that sounds like a simple declaratory statement. However, all pieces of that are open to argument. What is 20 years? How do you measure it? What is buildable? What's an adequate supply? What we're trying to get at with 3221 is not aimed at any particular jurisdiction, but we do have an example of some things up in the metro area right now and in Lane County where some of the issues that are bubbling beneath the surface of the legislation are causing problems, I think, for the planning system generally. Basically, the way it's supposed to work is every so often, 6 years in the case of Metro, periodic review or other review for other jurisdictions, they're supposed to look, make sure they have a 20-year supply of land.
the ultimate responsibility is to make sure they have an adequate supply of land for needed housing, which is a separate but very important analysis from the UGB piece. As part of that analysis, what they're supposed to do in a nutshell, in a summary fashion, is figure out how much buildable land they have inside the boundary, figure out what they're going to need for the next 20 years in terms of needed housing, for not just, and it's also commercial industrial land as well, and then see what they can do on the land they have inside the UGB currently, on their buildable lands, anything can be redeveloped, anything is vacant, that sort of thing. And then if compare those two numbers. If they have a greater land need than they currently have, they're supposed to either move the boundary, increase density, or both, density being a function of people per acre. That's the law currently. What we're trying to get at with HB 3221 is pretty simple. We'd like them to show their work in the margins. And I looked at the testimony that Metro prepared and put in. I'm sure they'll expand on that. And to a certain extent, what they're talking about in their testimony misses the point of the legislation, and we're happy to talk to them about clarifying this if need be. We're not nearly so much worried about the baseline analysis, because what the Dash 1s talk about first is to figure out what you have on the ground today. And from our standpoint, the only thing we know is what's been built. So you know what the codes are, you know what those codes have resulted in terms of density, units per acre, types of housing, and so on. You start there. And then if you look forward and say, we think that the market is changing, people want higher density, they want to live in a different way, they want a duplex versus triplex versus rent versus own, that's great. Show your work in the margins. Figure out how you get from the current state of affairs, which obviously has zoning in place, land use policies in place, and then the market has responded to those land use policies and zoning and created whatever's on the ground. If you think it's going to change in the future, tell us how that's going to happen. And simply hoping it'll happen or thinking it'd be better if it happened or making sure the boundary wouldn't move if it happened from our standpoint isn't sufficient. And I want to make it real clear, Mr. Chair and members, the point of 3221 is absolutely agnostic as to boundary movement. This is not about making it easier to move the boundary. It's about doing the planning necessary to analyze whether or not the boundary should be moved. But I think it'd be unfair, and we are certainly not supporting legislation that would say, do all these things, and when you're done, move the UGB anymore. But I think it's equally unfair to say, do all these things, but don't move the UGB and work backwards from that predetermined decision. The whole point of the exercise here, from our standpoint, is you do the analysis, you figure out what your land supply looks like, you do all the math you need to do, and you burn jaw sticks or disembowel chickens or whatever it is you do to guess about the next 20 years. And when you've done that, then you decide. Only then do you move a boundary or not. To start with, either assumption that the boundary is going to move or the boundary is not going to move screws up the math that you need to do in order to get to that decision in the first place. And just for the record, I've told my clients for many years now that if the market responds to and wants high density, it wants high rises, it wants houses shaped like donuts, whatever it might be, then we better figure out how to build them. This is not about cementing the status quo in amber or anything else. It's about making sure that the analysis is done properly. And just in my written testimony, I sent in an article that was written by Jerry Mildner from Portland State University that highlights in great detail some of the concerns that we have and Dr. Mildner shares about the work that Metro is doing. But just to give you an example of a couple things that, and I'm not here to argue about what's happening at Metro, these are illustrative of the point I'm trying to make with this legislation. The single-family, multifamily housing mix, historically, in the metro area, is 60% single-family, 40% multifamily. The way the planning is, the outcome or the conclusions could be drawn from the planning is that's going to be essentially reversed, so that multifamily be about 60-some-odd percent, single-family, 30-some-odd percent. If that's where actually the market is heading, if that's where consumer demand is going, if that's what people are going to be wanting, we have no problem with that. If, however, that is being driven by a desire not to move the boundary or through some other predetermined outcome, then we do have a problem with that. And the difficulty and the thing we're trying to address with 3221 is we don't know how we get from the current 60-40 one direction to 60-40 the other direction. Showing the work in the margins, elaborating on how that analysis is going to be, what sort of things are going to happen in terms of planning, rezoning, upzoning, market shifts, demographic changes, whatever they might be, that's what we think is lacking. As another example, not to pick on the city of Portland, since I don't think they're here today, and it's kind of unsporting to pick on them anywhere, not a moving target. Again, if you look at the assumptions that are being kicked around in this planning process, The historic average for the city of Bolton is about 2,500 housing units a year. You go back 13 years, I think is what the numbers were, about 2,500 units a year, single family, multifamily, attached, detached. That's what they've done year over year. In order to hit the numbers that seem to be being projected, that's going to have to over double and sustain that for 20 years. Again, if that's where the market's going, no problem with that. If it's not, significant problem. And the connection to other policy issues that this committee deals with is, and I think a lot of you understand this, the best way to protect farm and forest land is to make sure that development occurs inside of urban growth boundaries in a sensible fashion. The higher the density you get, the more people per acre you get, the less land you need, the less land you need, the less natural resource land you're talking about, farm, forest, slopes, etc. It doesn't do any of us any service, however, to have that analysis done incorrectly or incompletely, because all that does is put more pressure on the boundary, results in price increases and other sorts of dislocations, and frankly causes people, if they can't find what they're looking for inside of City 1, they'll look down the road at City 2 and commute back to City 1 if that's where the jobs are. So with this bill and with the amendments we're discussing, Mr. Chair and members, again, we are trying to simply, in a nutshell, say, show your work in the margins. We think that we've added some ideas here that will help in that, in order to get the documentation and the thinking behind how you go from where you are today to where you think the market is going to go, where you think the land use system ought to go. And whatever that answer is, we agree and pledge to live and die by that analysis, but we simply think that the system could use a little bit of help, and we think this bill will do that. I'll happily take questions. I'll conclude my testimony there. We hope that you'll schedule a work session, Mr. Chair, on this and give us a chance to move this bill along.
Questions for Mr. Chandler? Okay. Now, let's hear from the other side of the question. So, I actually, Alyssa Hansen, I don't know whether you're for, against, or neutral, but you can come anyway. And then, Aaron, did you want to? Well, actually, first, why don't we have Metro come up, since it's primarily their whatever it was, chicken bones and witch doctor skills at risk. Particularly, Mr. Tucker, I think, is going to give us all the technical data and all the answers. No,
right.
Because you have a friend with you who might offer some knowledge about this. And then we look for a solo operator here. Maybe Mary Kyle, could you? I just want to fill a third seat, and you other two seem linked. So, okay.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Randy Tucker, Metro's Legislative Affairs Manager. I'm merely the color man to John Williams' play-by-play here.
Okay.
So I'll let John give Metro's testimony. If I have anything to add, I will add it. But I just want to note that I've just, while listening to Mr. Chandler's testimony, sent into the committee, to the administrators, a piece of information from the Oregon Employment Department, I believe, non-Metro data showing that the first three quarters of, I think it was last year, I'm not looking at it right now, City of Portland built 5,000 units of housing. So there's definitely a lot of information out there, as John will discuss, and anyway, I'll just leave it at that right now.
Okay, thanks, Randy. Chair Clam, members of the committee, thank you for the time today. My name is John Williams. I'm Deputy Director of the Planning Department in Metro, and here in opposition to House Bill 3221. And I would just point out before I start speaking that this bill affects more than just Metro, cities over 25,000 across the state. I'm not here on behalf of them. But Metro certainly does do an incredible amount of work on this topic. Under state law, Metro is responsible for assessing the region's ability to accommodate 20 years of growth, and we take that responsibility very seriously. And our region has seen a tremendous amount of growth, 400,000 people in the last 20 years, 400,000 people in the next 20 years, and we've worked hard to direct that growth following state policy context, regional policy, local policy, all directs that growth to main streets, town centers, all across the region. That policy continues to enjoy strong public support in our region. And we've seen a tremendous amount of market response. So you just heard from Mr. Chandler about the challenge of Portland accommodating growth across the region. But in fact, as the piece that Randy just sent you shows, that the majority of growth year after year in recent years in our region has been in those places in the city of Portland. And so if there's one trend that's happening in that city and in cities all across the country, it's that there's a tremendous amount of development happening in those communities. Metro, every time we have looked at the urban growth boundary over the past 30 years, we have added land to the urban growth boundary. And I think we have continued to see that as a part of our toolbox moving forward. But the fact is, development out there in areas added has been extremely slow, as it has been in many areas inside the UGB. So over the last 14 years, you've seen 6,500 homes built in the 32,000 acres of land that have been added to our UGB over time. And so it's a struggle. And so I think one of the key messages we're learning is that development everywhere is difficult. There's a common thread of needed infrastructure, of needed governance, of understanding the market response to all the places that we're interested in providing land. And so I think we are shooting for continued partnerships with Mr. Chandler's organizations and lots of other folks to have the full suite of development happen in our region. I do want to address just a couple of things that that he brought up, and I'm going to take a little bit of your time just talking about some of the detail. I think what you heard from him is show our work in the margins. Well, I want to show you what we already do, thanks to a very extensive set of state statutes on this. This is our urban growth report. It's well over an inch thick. It's double printed. There's a lot of work. We do have a lot of margins in here that we could write more in. But I think what I'm here to tell you just a little bit about is what we do in that serious response to the assignment that the state has given us. To conduct this review, which we do every 5 years, 6 years in the future, we assemble dozens of experts from the public and private sector, academic world. Every time we do this report, it gets more involved. It gets more transparent. And I think what you see, if you look at this draft, and if you talk to the homebuilders, I'm sure they'd say, is we've been more open than ever before. We're pioneering new ways to understand what growth has happened and will happen in our region. And so just a flavor of that, to develop our buildable land inventory, we start at the individual tax lot level. We look at aerial photos of the entire region. We ask experts how to handle environmental constraints like steep slopes, like wetlands, habitat areas. We deduct those from our ability, from our assumptions. We remove future street rights away. When you're looking at infill and redevelopment potential, we ask developers what they'd be willing to pay for properties all across the region. We compare that to existing property values, and we use that to evaluate what areas might see redevelopment and infill over the next 20 years. So what we end up with is a detailed map of redevelopment potential for the next 20 years over the entire region, which we then send to every city and county for their review and comment. And I think what I'm trying to say is that the work that we do is incredibly thorough. It takes us more than a year. It has an incredible amount of public input. And it is based, to our best understanding, of what the private sector may build over the next 20 years. We're extremely interested in that. And you'll see some quotes from the home builders who were very involved in this process along the way, complimenting the process. Comprehensive approach includes robust data gathering and detailed analysis. I won't quote the whole thing. I think the general theme is we do a tremendous amount of work, and there's really a lot of disagreement about what to do with it. How do we make all of the areas that we're all interested in grow? I think what our view of this bill is, we oppose these Dash 1 amendments because, in our view, it creates new, more difficult, more complicated requirements for the technical work that we already do. It's essentially an overburdened statute that we're looking at right now. We do all of this technical work to provide baseline information to the Metro Council and to the region for their policy decision making. All of this technical work that we do doesn't answer the question. It just provides us with information. I think we have plenty of information to base that decision making on. And if I should take the time to talk about a few of our specific concerns about some of the language, I can do that. Or if you'd like me to wrap up, I know we have a shortage of time, I'd be happy to do that too.
Well, let's have Mary Kyle talk, because she's pretty usually right on point on point, so they may be the ones you're about to do, so let's let her see, and then maybe come back if you need some more.
Good afternoon, Chair Clem and members of the committee. Mary Kyle McCurdy, Policy Director at 1000 Friends of Oregon. I'm not sure I'm going to live up to that billing you just gave, but I will try to do my best. But the succinct point is we oppose House Bill 3221 and the -1 amendments. We all share the goal of increasing opportunity for housing inside urban growth boundaries. We're seeing a tremendous demand for it, not just in the metro area, but definitely in the Willamette Valley and in areas outside the Willamette Valley. People across the United States who are interested in living in cities, and we're all concerned about how to help cities do that better and make more opportunities for diverse and affordable housing types. However, this bill seems designed to cripple the ability of cities to efficiently and accurately conduct a buildable lands analysis and take actions to meet that increasing housing demand by burying them in make-work record-keeping tasks. As you've heard, the bill introduces some vague new terms into the residential land analysis that sound sort of like what cities already do, but a little bit different in terms, and it requires them to conduct work based on some faulty assumptions and really overburdensome work tasks. And we submitted written testimony, but I'm going to give a few examples. For example, it requires that cities evaluate any covenants, restrictions, and declarations on every tax lot and parcel to see if there's any diminishment of building capacity. That is an intensive make-work project on every tax lot, residential tax lot and parcel in a city, which doesn't give one much information because many of those are stale and unenforced anyway. It has a long list of things for cities to do, monitor and record, specify, account for, most of which is already done or might all be already done, but these are, again, new words that are introduced to it. I think the main thing here is that there is an apparent attempt to, I think, discount the amount of buildable land inside urban growth boundaries in order to justify urban growth boundary expansions. As you've heard from Metro, they've expanded their boundary by about 32,000 acres since in their existence. 95% of all housing starts in the metro area have been built within the 1979 urban growth boundary. Only 5% have gone into those 32,000 acres. Most of those have been single-family homes. Those are not diverse, affordable housing types and not located in easy-to-reach areas. And they are expensive to serve. That's why they're generally not affordable. We are finding the same challenge in providing more housing opportunities that we find in attracting industrial users to the existing industrial lands in the metro area everywhere. Metro has 8,000 acres of land zoned for industrial use and parcels over 25 acres. This is a great supply, just like there's a great supply of residential capacity. But cities and Metro need to take the steps to invest, find money to invest in transportation and other improvements, to make sidewalks, provide transit, create local improvement districts, create urban renewal districts, all the things that turn land into something that's built upon. That's easier to do inside an urban growth boundary than it is outside an urban growth boundary. I don't think we should be passing a bill that makes it harder to do what's already happening. LCDC has done a survey of cities across Oregon, and cities of all sizes in all parts of the state are naturally increasing their densities as they have those investment and policy tools to put in place inside their cities. Densities are increasing. And the city of Portland has hit that 4,500-plus dwelling unit mark for the last few years. This is not an issue of the land. It's an issue of our collective investments in the policies for the and infrastructure to make that land ready to go. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I could add just two quick comments, and John may have to correct me on one of them. I believe Mr. Chandler stated that we're predicting that a complete reversal in the percentage of housing that would be single-family versus multifamily. I don't believe that's accurate. I believe what we're projecting is that at the end of the that there will be a shift in the mix that is built going forward, but at the end of that, we'd still have a 60% single-family, 40% multifamily mix. John can correct me if I've blown that.
That's exactly right.
And then there's one more thing. I'm gonna submit this for the record. Just I meant to do it beforehand. I'll just hold it up right now. This is the list of public and private and academic sector experts and regional staff that participated in the development of the Urban Growth Report. This is not something that we do in our, you know, bubble at Metro. We talk to a lot of people that know a lot of stuff and that tell us what they believe and that tell us when we're wrong and that help to shape this methodology. It's not something that that we just make up, you know, based on an outcome that we want to predetermine. It's just not done that way. So I just want to make that very clear, and I'll provide this list to you. Thank you.
Okay, great. I'm going to get Alyssa and Aaron up here because I know Alyssa came from Eugene probably for this. And then Eric, what category are you in, really?
Opposed as introduced, but with an idea.
Okay. Well, why don't you come up and tell us about it?
Pursuant to Alyssa's request, I'm going to go first. Chair Clem, members of the committee, for the record, Aaron Doyle with the League of Oregon Cities. I am going to be brief because I have an expert here. The League is opposed to this bill in both the both originally drafted and in the dash ones that we've seen, largely because we believe this is going to create a huge record-keeping burden with no benefit to the cities, and instead we're going to end up seeing a slower, longer, more tedious, more intensive, more appealable, more fraught with hazards of difficult passage of UGBs just based on the buildable land supply and the additional information that we would have to be showing all of the work on to justify what we think were work that we're already doing. The reporting requirements seem to just add more papers and not more information. I believe that our city planners work, especially in our large cities, they're not afraid to tackle growth where growth is necessary, but also are trying to do the most with the infrastructure that they have and are balancing all of those things and are doing that when they're doing their UGB expansion reviews, looking at the lands that they have. And this bill will just add more work for no benefit other than more papers being produced, which might be beneficial to the paper industry in Oregon, which is fine. But without the technical expertise, I can't really explain how it is that our cities do that. And I believe that's why Alyssa is here from the city of Eugene, so I'll just end my testimony there and answer any questions you might have.
Okay, great. Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Klim and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Alyssa Hansen. I am a planner with the city of Eugene who focuses on these types of issues. I'm also a member of DLCD's Rules Advisory Committee for the new urban growth boundary process, which is supposed to streamline this process. I am here today to talk about some of the implications of HB 3221 and the Dash 1 amendments and our concerns as those relate to some of the work that we're currently doing on our residential lands inventory. So we've been diligently working over the last several years on our buildable lands inventory and our housing our analysis of those lands for capacity for employment and housing. While we're not the size of Metro, our UGB is fairly large in that we've got over 34,000 acres and over 6,100 tax lots. So as you might imagine, this is a fairly extensive process. We've involved several citizen groups with a diverse representation, land use advocates, neighborhood folks, business owners, home building association, and they've provided us advice at every step along the way. And we also, similar to Metro, have had a very transparent and robust process. I mean, if you want to see any of our work, we have boxes of documents that show, you know, everything that we have looked at. Because we are deep into this inventory and analysis work that is fairly prescribed by the state statutes, I think one of the most concerning things to us is that it's not clear what several of these changes are intended to do. As several of the other speakers alluded, in some ways it appears to be just a rewording of what we assume we're already required to do. If cities are assuming they're going to grow at higher densities, we're supposed to prove up at that. And this is now rewritten just slightly differently. In other ways, there's some reorganizations and changing of terms that, frankly, to us, it's unclear what the intent is. And that is fairly concerning because I couldn't tell you what the implications are of those. I do want to speak to one practical implication that will clearly add, or would clearly add, significant complexities to our analysis. So on page 2 of the Dash 1 amendments, there's a proposed requirement to evaluate covenants, restrictions, and declarations in recorded instruments, also known as CC&Rs or deed restrictions. So we looked at this issue actually really early on in our analysis and our process, and for a number of reasons determined that it wasn't reasonable for our jurisdiction to go forward and consider those. So let me just play this out. So we have over 3,000 tax lots that would be considered buildable, that are vacant or partially vacant. So for each of those tax lots, each of those 3,000 tax lots, we would actually need to pull from the county the CC&Rs or any deed restrictions that are associated with those. Or we could pay a title company. We could have staff do it, or we could pay a title company, and they typically charge about $300 for a title report. It's the going rate. Once we got a copy of each of those CC&Rs or deed restrictions, which can range anywhere from 2 to 100 pages, we would need to review them all and interpret their impact on the capacity of those lands for residential use. We'd have to see, do they ban land divisions? Do they ban additional dwellings? Do they ban secondary dwellings? And then we would need to reconcile our buildable lands inventory and our housing capacity analysis to figure out, you know, what the implications were of that. On the other hand, while we're doing that, we don't have authority to actually enforce these CC&Rs. These are private contracts between neighbors, property owners, developers. We don't enforce them. We don't even look at them when a building permit comes in the door or a land division comes in the door. We're not allowed to enforce them. We also know that they're not equally enforced in neighborhoods. Sure, there are some that are, you know, don't want their white rock between the sidewalk and the house, but there are others that are completely ignored. Some of these are decades old. Some of them, you know, may expire mid-planning period, and that would be problematic. They get changed without us knowing. It would be really difficult to track these. So for Eugene, it would be making this a requirement would really be onerous in both time and money, and not an accurate representation of the actual development potential of these residential lands. So, you know, overall, given the vagueness and then this concerning issue, I'd like to see some clarification of a lot of the language before we can further comment and understand the impact of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. And Eric, why don't you tell us your exciting idea in 2 minutes or less?
Sure. Chair Clem, members of the committee, for the record, Eric Kanzler representing the city of Bend. And this is really one of the interesting things about cities. It's illustrated by the difference between Eugene's experience and Bend's experience. There's not a right or a wrong. There's just vastly differing local scenarios. And we've actually, I don't need to talk about how comprehensive our UGP expansion effort has been, because I've done that, and I'll probably be up here again talking about that. As part of that effort, however, we've taken a pretty comprehensive look at the effect of CC&Rs on our buildable lands. And it's frankly been considerable expense for the city. It's very time-consuming. It's a very unique situation probably that we're in, but it's one that makes sense for getting a beat on what capacity we actually have to provide. And so while we are opposed to the bill as introduced and to the Dash 1, I think we would frankly very much like to see, call it a gut and stuff or whatever, a much simpler bill that simply provided an optional safe harbor for cities that felt that CC&Rs ought to be taken into account when they do their buildable lands inventories. It makes sense for us. It may not make sense for anybody else, and that's why we think cities should have the choice. We feel that we've got a pretty good legal grounds for doing what we're doing. Staff tells me that the agency has been there in support of what we're doing, but it is somewhat vulnerable. So if we did have statutory clarity as an option, that would be preferable. For us, that would be great, in fact, because that would take one more uncertainty away from us as we endeavor to expand our UGP. Thank you.
Okay, great. Any questions? Okay, thank you. I forgot I had Bob Rindy in lurking. Do you think you can do it in a minute, or do you want to meet to talk about Dash 2s with everybody else I'm about to assign to go meet and talk about Dash 2s?
Mr. Chairman of the Committee, Bob Rendy with the LCD. I'd be happy to forego my testimony. I do plan to give you some in writing. I do did want you to know that we have been in discussions with Mr. Chandler on this bill, and we are continuing to do that. And we have concerns, some of which have been described, some that haven't been, frankly, because we're not too thrilled about going back and doing a lot of rules about those large cities that are swept in by this bill when we're working on a new streamlined process, and when probably half of those cities are somewhere along the line have already done work that we don't think should be thrown back because of this. So that's it in a nutshell, but we will be providing you some written testimony. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, that's my list. So with that, let me close the public hearing on House Bill 3221. I think we're going to try and assemble some of the folks from today to talk further about this. I need to carry over House Bills 2723 and 3457. And let me actually just ask, on 3457, the person from Tax Fairness, you are here?
Yes. Pardon me. I'm Mr. Judge.
It's not your fault. I just am not hearing it because the sponsors aren't here, but I now feel sort of badly that you're here. Are you somebody who comes not to the Capitol often, or?
Yes, I'm a volunteer.
Come on. How the problem is the sponsors aren't even here to tell us about the bill, so no one's going to know what you're complaining about. I think you're against it, right?
Yes, I make a pretty good summary of the bill. I'll be glad to wait.
If you don't, it won't be a few minutes though, because they're literally not here today. So we might need to have you or someone from your organization come back when the sponsors are here, just so it's not one-sided and there's nobody to speak in favor, and then it's just you against, and that's the end of our total public hearing.
In the interim, you'll take the opportunity to review the testimony.
Comment to me. Absolutely. Absolutely. We'll have a hearing on it. It's just there's nobody here to speak in favor of it, so it's kind of awkward. Okay, so with that, I carried over the two, and I think we're going to try and get the other folks who don't like our urban agricultural thing to speak with Ivan and I, because we have an amendment that we hope deals with a lot of the concerns. It's just not back yet. And with that, let me adjourn the committee. Thanks.